This gets into the defining moment on why I went back. There was a man that was carrying a younger gal out like a pair of scissors. So I would come in, I'd lift him up, I'd throw him over my shoulder, and I'd run out. It was at that moment that I realized that there was going to be a lot of people that needed help. He said, "Where are we going next?" I said, "Who are you?" He goes, "Brother," he goes, "I'm with you. Like, you're picking him up and carrying him out, and we're fixing him up." I truly understand what you go through and where you've been, and that silence that happens when everything gets to that moment where you can really think about what the hell just happened to me.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience, along with my co-hosts, Bonnie Rumley, LCSW, EMT. I'm David Dashinger. In this episode, we'll be speaking with Todd Blylevin of the Walking Tall movement about his professional sports background, being a mass shooting survivor in Las Vegas in 2017, EMDR therapy, living with PTSD, and how Todd learned to walk tall again. This episode is made possible by Cover, an all-natural, chemical-free mineral sunscreen lotion. Providing broad-spectrum protection in an SPF 30, Cover blocks 97% of harmful UVA and UVB rays, but it's light enough to allow your skin to breathe. First responders often spend long hours in the sun, and prolonged skin exposure is one of the hazards of the job. First responders love Cover because it won't stain clothing, and a 4-ounce bottle fits easily into a backpack or go bag. Go to kovr.respondertv.com to get 15% off all Cover sunscreen products. That's kovr.respondertv.com. Like and subscribe on YouTube, Responder Resilience, Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., and Responder TV. We're on bbsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, and all the podcast platforms. And come to our website, respondertv.com, for past episodes and guest information. We'll be right back to speak with Todd after this.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Responder Resilience with co-hosts, retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Rumley, LCSW, EMTB.
Being in baseball, that was my life. I not only just wanted to be a big leaguer, but I wanted to be my dad. It's a no blood, no foul mentality growing up. You battle through things. You get over things.
We have an active shooter inside the fairgrounds. He's coming from up there. It's Evangeline Bay.
We were directly in the line of fire.
Everybody kept asking, "Where's Todd?" I don't know.
I said, "Dad, like, this isn't something you just get over."
Today we're joined by Todd Blylevin, who is a beacon of courage and resilience. As a heroic civilian rescuer during the Las Vegas Country Music Festival shooting in 2017, Todd's selflessness saved lives, earning him widespread acclaim. Overcoming PTSD, he embarked on a transformative path to regain strength through faith, peer support, and EMDR therapy. With a professional baseball background and expertise in sports technology, Todd's unwavering determination shines through. As a captivating speaker and advocate for personal growth, he offers profound insights on resilience and triumph over adversity, and with an unwavering commitment to help others walk tall again. Todd, warm welcome to Respond to Resilience.
Thank you so much for having me on this. And I'd just first like to thank every single first responder, our military, anybody that's put on the uniform to go out and help another individual. So thank you for both of you and what you've done, and all of our listeners and everybody. I'm just so honored to be a part of this show. So thank you.
Thank you. It's great to see you again. And thank you for being one of us without the uniform.
Yeah.
so, should we just jump right into the meat of everything?
Why not?
So as we talk about your story and the things that have happened to shape who you are today, and talking about the Standing Tall movement, Walking Tall, really, why do you think it's so difficult to tell your family or close friends when you're struggling mentally?
You know, this is a great topic to discuss. And I think, you know, if I take a step back into my own personal journey going through, you know, my dad played professional baseball. He was a very tough individual. He's in the Hall of Fame.
Todd Blylevin was a member of that Pittsburgh Pirates family. The seven-year-old served as the club's bat boy, and he was the son of Hall of Fame pitcher Burt Blylevin.
Not too often you get an opportunity to have your children come to where you work. I think it grows character in a lot of the young kids of seeing if they have a dream to play baseball, and Todd had that opportunity.
And to go through that household and watch your parents, especially in that generation where everything was meant to be tough. We grew up in a society where if we fell off our bike, it was get up, dust yourself off, no blood, no foul, and move on, and suppress your inner feelings, right? Even though maybe we were hurting on the inside, we definitely didn't want to show it on the outside. And so I think when you go into that mentality in life now, especially as an adult, you know, it brings on a lot of different challenges because we have a lot of other weight that we're carrying as well with our kids or our bills or our jobs and things. And especially if you're a first responder, you know, and going through those call after call, sometimes you don't get that moment of silence where everything compacts in that fear moment. So to be able to process that individually, sometimes you're going from call to call to call, or in my situation in Las Vegas, and we'll get into that, where I was going one after another, you don't get that opportunity to really think about things. And I think that sometimes we have to start reshaping our own mindsets and understanding that it's okay to be vulnerable. It's okay to tell somebody, hey, you know what? I'm struggling right now. And coming from a sports field and where I was going with, you know, my dad growing up and me playing professional baseball.
I not only just wanted to be a big leaguer, but I wanted to be my dad.
Todd had a dream, like I did, to play baseball. It doesn't come easy. You don't roll out of bed and all of a sudden, you know, be able to compete.
Todd was a legitimate amateur prospect and went on to pitch five seasons in the minors. But he never advanced past double A ball. Never got to live out that goal of doing as his dad had done.
I wasn't my dad. There's not many people that were like my dad. He's in the Hall of Fame.
I never really had a manager that I could go to and say, hey, Skip, like, I had a hard day with my girlfriend, or I'm not mentally there 100% right now. My mind's somewhere else. And because if I did, I'm going to be told, hey, go out and run. Go clear your head. Go lift weights. Go. Sure. Don't bother me with that stuff. And it's the same that applies to our first responders. And now we're starting to see this amazing movement of transparency. And you have this younger generation coming up that's way more vulnerable and accepting and wanting that. Mm-hmm. And so you have this conflict now. But I think when I look at it, I ask a simple question. If I'm going to go to battle with somebody and I'm going to put my life on the line and I'm going to trust you, in that moment of pure chaos, then I need to be able to trust you afterwards. I need to be able to be open enough to be able to say, you know what I saw, that 13 seconds of time in my life, it was hard. I think about it every single day. And if you hear my voice start to crack, if you hear me kind of mumble my words a little bit, this is what I'm going through. And that's where I'm at today. I tell people, like, if I'm feeling a little nervous, if I go to a convention or if I'm at a ball game, whatever I'm at, if my back's up against the wall, people will ask, like, hey, why don't you come join us? No, I'm fine. You know what? Like, this is just my situation. This is where I'm at, and this is my comfort zone. And as long as I'm transparent and open, they understand where I'm at, and then it's a lot more acceptable. So I think, like, that's a long answer to your for your question, but we need to start being more vulnerable, and especially any first responder that's tough as nails. Anybody that puts on that badge to either go out and do that job day in and day out, our military, our medical staff, our animal control, anybody that's going out and doing a job that has adversity, you've already like, you're tough. That box is checked. You don't need to be any stronger. Nobody's ever going to question your toughness. But you need to understand that it's okay now to be vulnerable. You're not weak in that. And so I think that's my biggest mission to try to tell people is that nobody's ever going to call me weak for what I did. I've checked my box. But it's being vulnerable now. And I find serious strength in that. You know, I find that brings me peace. To be able to, you know, open up my heart and share my adversities and show that I'm not Captain America. You know, that guy the ending was a little bad. I didn't like the ending, but so I think it's just a matter of reshaping our mindsets and understanding. You know, I get a lot of calls with what I did, my actions in Las Vegas. And going through EMDR, it's not easy. You've got to put your boot forward. You need to recognize the headaches. You need to understand that, you know, what you're experiencing, a lot of other people have experienced in terms of the feeling. You're processing it differently on how with your own personal backgrounds, but you need to unleash that vulnerability and allow the process to happen for you to get help. People always ask, like, you know, the differences between first responders and athletes, right? It's the same. It's a team, right? I mean, obviously, athletes are not going and doing what you both did and saving lives and dealing with all of the hardships of our society. But it's that camaraderie. It's that team atmosphere. And so you got to rely on that, you know, rely on your brothers and sisters to be able to help you out in times of need.
Great points, Todd. I'd love to rewind a little bit and talk about your defining moment and how that plays out. Because if we agree that we're like the sum of our experiences, that, you know, the upbringing from our family and the lessons that we learn on the path of life, sometimes we're all faced with a situation that becomes our defining moment. And with that situation comes a choice. So can you share about your experience in Las Vegas and the choices you made?
It was October 1st, 2017. I think it's important to know that I had been to this concert in Las Vegas multiple times. It's a 3-day country fest. It was a time for me and my wife, and we call them our family members, and some of them were my actual nieces and nephews, my brother-in-law and his wife, but we would congregate in Vegas for a 3-day party. And that was our release from life. You know, we all go through struggles. And on this particular year, you know, my wife and I were going through some things. And so there was a lot of heaviness going into this. It was an important trip to go and try to find this new, you know, kind of reconnection with us personally.
Mm-hmm. With their marriage at stake, Todd and Kathy planned a trip in 2017. One last-ditch effort to rekindle the spark they had lost over the years. They picked a place where they could return to their relationship's roots, dancing and country music. They bought their tickets to the Route 91 Harvest Festival in Las Vegas.
And so, you know, we're going, and the first couple nights there, you know, obviously you're listening to some, I'm a huge country fan, so you're listening to some great music. Vegas did a great job. You know, Vegas PD and Fire, they're just amazing individuals. You know, they did a great job with making sure the grounds were secure in terms of providing that presence there for people to go and have a good time. So when you walked into that venue, you felt comfortable. You know, and they did all the right things. But at the time, prior to that first shot, you know, you go through a metal detector and you're like, oh, I'm safe, you know, and so is everybody else. And so you walk in and you just go have some drinks and we're having a good time. And I think the first 2 days really set the tone for what happened and for my own reset, because the feeling was all about love. And there we are. I mean, it's a perfect night. The wind is perfect. The temperature is perfect. Jason Aldean's on stage, one of my favorite singers. And I'm dancing, and I've got 18 of us. We're all like, you know, right back about 20 yards from the stage. Jason was the last artist on the last of the 3 days, and we decided to stay back. And I don't know why, but we're all back, and we're just having fun. And I'm dancing with my niece. I'm swinging dancing, and we're just having so much fun. And then all of a sudden you hear a couple little cracks. You started to hear some crackling noises. And it sounded like people were saying fireworks and things. To me, it was just loud little bangs. And the next song started playing. Then you start to see people fall.
He said, "We need to get down, everybody get down."
We were directly in a line of fire. And all you can think of at that moment is, I got to get my wife out.
I always saw officers to my right by the VIP stage. And those guys were always sitting there most of the time. You know, they had their vests on. And so there was no movement. And then you heard a couple more cracks. And now you start to see a little bit of movement. And then the unthinkable happened, where a machine gunner from the 32nd floor across the street in Mandalay Bay decided to open fire on 26,000 people. And at first, when you heard the crackling sound, which is a truly unique sound, I instantly thought maybe there was a drive-by going on Las Vegas Boulevard. And so your vigilance is at high alert. Mm-hmm. You're trying to understand, you know, what is going on. Are you in immediate danger? But Jason's still playing. Mm-hmm. So was it maybe my imagination? It wasn't a machine gun. So you start going through all these questions in your mind. You know, in that venue, you've got about like 7-foot, 8-foot walls that are blocking you from the boulevard. So immediately I'm looking at the officers that are to my right, and now they're on their walkie talkies and there's some movement happening, but Jason's still playing. Mm-hmm. So was it an isolated incident? You're going through all these processes. Now we're not dancing anymore. I've got my wife right here in front of me. I got my brother-in-law, 18 of these people, which, mind you, these are kids that I taught how to pitch in Little League. These are early 20s, you know, younger kids that were with us, which a couple, by the way, are firefighters now, which was pretty amazing. But in that moment, your heightened sense of alert starts to come up, your vigilance. And then the second round started, and that's when Jason Aldean stopped, ran off the stage. You're starting to hear all the screams. The whole concert goes down in the ground. You're throwing your wife in the ground. And now I'm on one knee, and I identified where the shooting was coming from because I saw a muzzle flash on that 32nd floor across the street. Anyways, I knew we were sitting ducks. There was no coverage. So I wanted to be able to get my wife and family to a secure location.
We were directly in a line of fire. And all you can think of at that moment is, I got to get my wife out. I got to get my wife out. So you react, you grab, you pull, everybody gets up, and you run. As we started to run, I noticed that there was a man carrying a younger woman, and I went over to help him. She was lifeless. The touch of her, you know, when I helped grab her wrist and I had her boot and we laid her down, I just knew I needed to do something.
We were up against a building and he said, "Baby, I'm going to go back in and help because that's what I need to do."
What possessed you to go back in there?
I had legs under me. I had arms that worked, and I knew there were going to be a lot of people that needed help.
Oh my God.
So I kissed my wife, and, you know, she had this dazed look on her face. And my brother-in-law obviously wasn't very happy with me, but he took the two girls and ran off, and I ran back in. When I ran back in, obviously the shooting was still going on at the moment. I think the third round had just started, or the fourth. And there was an elderly woman there at probably about 15 feet into that gate, and she was hobbling out, and I went and picked her up, and I set her down by the squad car. And I set her down, and then I jumped back up. And as I started to run back in, there was a wave of probably 20 people that were coming out. And a blonde-haired, 5 foot nothing two woman, older, you know, probably in her early 50s or late 40s, said, "I'm a trained ER trauma nurse. What can I do to help?" And she grabbed my right shoulder as I was running in, and I said, "Ma'am," I said, "there's women down. There's an officer, I believe, that's injured. You need to go put your hands on those people and do what you need to do. I'll be back." And so fast forwarding on what she did, this brave woman ended up managing three makeshift triage centers on Giles Street and probably saved hundreds of lives. She's a true inspiration and hero, and just being total selfless act. She just didn't stop. And she represents a star that I have on a tattoo, a tribute tattoo. After I went back in from that moment, there was a woman, a group of people in that same Budweiser booth calling for help. And there was a woman that had been shot a couple times. And so I went around the corner screaming for help, medic, corpsman, somebody, and another brave soul. A woman came out. She was a nurse. That's how she identified herself. And I shielded her. The gunfire was starting to happen again. She tucked into my arm, and I ran her over and jumped her over the counter, and this woman saved this woman's life. So it was immediately, you're automatically just these four, you know, EMT and the first responders and people were coming out of this is a country concert, mind you. So, you know, there was a lot of people there that were off duty, and they just stepped right into action and put their lives on the line for other people. And so it was inspiring, and I just kept going. And so, you know, I went further and further each time I would go and grab somebody and pull them out. I'd come up on a group that they had a hard time carrying or dragging someone out. And so I would come in, I'd lift them up, I'd throw them over my shoulder, and I'd run out. Or I'd carry them over my arms, depending on the size of the victim.
Everybody kept asking, "Where's Todd?" "I don't know. Where's Todd?" "I don't know. I don't know. He went back in."
I was running into the field, and I noticed there was about 100 people that were taking coverage, and they were all lined up. What they didn't realize was right on the other side of these food vending trucks, there was a gate that was open. And I'm waving people, saying, "Let's go, let's go." And they all start coming out. Well, now the shooting's coming at us, and you're seeing bodies now. And so I was running from body to body, checking pulses.
But that was my mentality, was just trying to go back and forth as quick as possible and get them back to Giles. That was my safe haven. Mm-hmm. So through that experience, I ended up coming up on Rachel Parker and her friends.
And that's when I came upon Rachel Parker.
A records technician with the Manhattan Beach Police Department, Rachel Parker attended the Route 91 concert with her coworker.
She was the most bubbliest person ever. If something was going on, you know, personally, she was always there for other people.
Rachel was shot by a madman still firing from the 32nd floor at the Mandalay Bay.
We needed to either get her to safety so she's not hurt again, or completely get out of the venue.
You know, I was able to, with their help, get Rachel up.
And he threw her over his shoulder and we ran out to the cab and he put her in there.
You know, she didn't make it. I didn't know that at the time.
She died the next day at the hospital. Rachel Parker was 33.
So I ended up, there was a car that had pulled up, a female driver, and I ended up sticking Rachel and her friends into this vehicle. And I remember, you know, and this is where like the EMDR therapy really helped me through this whole process. And the way I'm recounting this is post EMDR, because right. You know, your trauma, your movie that you have in your head is all miscombobulated. But I remember in that moment, I was yelling at an individual and screaming at this man. And I couldn't remember why I was screaming at this man standing by this car. And I'm screaming at this man. I'm like, don't you understand what's going on? I need you to get into this car. And I didn't understand at the moment, like after it took me months to try to figure this out through EMDR. And finally, after meeting Rachel's friends, they told me what had happened. They said, do you remember yelling at that guy? And I'm like, no. Oh, my God. That's where I was at in that moment. And it turns out I for whatever reason, I wanted this man to get into this car to ride with Rachel and her friends and this driver. I don't understand why, but I was so upset with that. And then they took off and then I ran back in. But it was amazing to hear that I wasn't crazy, number one, and that there was validation of where I was at in that moment. Unfortunately, Rachel passed away in the hospital you know, hours later.
You know, that's the other part. You're trying to just grab and run as fast as you can.
It goes to show that people who aren't first responders for a living can act in such a way, and it really does show me that there is still good people out in the world.
I'd imagine you developed a tunnel vision of just pulling people out of this world and into a safer world, and you just kept doing it.
I just, you know, all I kept trying to tell myself was keep my boots moving forward. You know, the David and Goliath story, you know, it goes back to that. You're encountering this beast, and you deal with the adversity right then and there, you get back up.
58 victims were fatally wounded that night.
It was a very difficult thing for me post that event, because you don't know who lived and who did not, unless, I mean, I had three women die in my arms that night, which was extremely difficult and hard. But all I tried to do was run back and forth. You know, I think the more inspiring piece to what happened on that night is each time that I would go in and I would bring somebody out, there were more people that were following me and there were more people that were going in. There was a moment when I laid a woman down and I think she was okay. Her injury was not life-threatening. And I got back up and an EMT was sitting there and he said, and he had his shirt off and he had his EMT, you know, pouch around his front chest. And he said, where are we going next? I said, who are you? He goes, brother, he goes, I'm with you. Like, we've been with you. You're picking him up and carrying him out and we're fixing him up.
So you were involved for the full 8 hours?
The full 8 hours. Yeah.
Wow.
We were told there was a shooter at Tropicana. And so, and there were people that needed to be loaded into ambulances. Ambulances were using the back of Tropicana now as a staging front. So more people were being transported there and then hopping into it like an Uber line of ambulances starting to show up on the scene. And so me, the EMT, a fire captain out of San Francisco, and a former Marine, we all jumped up and ran across the parking lot down the street to go help and get these people loaded up. So as we're doing that, my wife and I are now in conversation for the first time. I have no clue where she's at. And I told her where I was at. And then an officer rolled up on the scene and said, we need to get everybody inside. There's a shooter on the roof, shooter in the building. We need to get everybody into these. It was the back service entrance of Tropicana. And we're building this triage kind of center area in a secure location for those that are in dire need to get that help. And so you have EMTs on scene. Mm-hmm. That was kind of the towards the end of the chaotic part of the night, where now they've started migrating people into a hallway, into a ballroom. We're profiling now everybody, mm-hmm. because we don't know who's who. You're just now like in full protective mode until finally two SWAT officers came up on me, and one of them put their hand on my shoulder. I was obviously covered in a lot of stuff by carrying a lot of people out, and they said, "Sir, we have this. You can stand down." And at that moment, I just collapsed, and it was amazing that these two individuals just stood over me and almost kind of protected me and let me go through my moment that I really needed at that time. And I think too, that was one of the first times in that whole night that I had realized like what just happened. Mm. And I felt the pain of the three women that died in my arms, and everything just hit me at once. And I'm not an emotional person, and I was raised to take it all in and suck it up, you know? But I started to break down, and I had these people just come up and offer their hands and their love. And they were just there for me. And it was just truly, it was amazing.
On a baseball field, Todd had failed to meet the expectations that came with his last name. But in that field in Vegas, he had been a hero.
It's almost like a fireman, you know, a policeman. Anybody that, you know, is willing to give up their lives to help others. Todd was all that at that one moment when he said, I'm going to go back in. And that's why I'm very, very proud of him for what he did.
So I had 1% battery life left on my phone, and now I've got to try to find my wife. So I ended up being able to track her. She was actually at a place called Desert Rose, which was right behind Tropicana. So they let us all out. I don't even know what time it was, 6 o'clock in the morning or something. And I was able to walk back and find her and embrace her in the lobby of the Desert Rose.
Hours after sprinting in and out of the concert venue and lugging dozens of bodies, Todd found Kathy.
Just hold him as tight as you can. And thankful that we actually came home.
As a civilian, you're like, now what do I do? I've got nobody. I'm not supposed to report to anyone. There's no structure. I'm supposed to go and decompress. Here I am. I've got all these things. I just experienced all of these things. I don't know how to find out if people are okay, mm-hmm. that I helped. There's no communication. So, and then we get back and fast forward. I get into my truck at the DFW airport and I get a phone call. And that phone call came from an individual named Lee. We'll leave it at that. But he is a friend of my dad's, former military combat vet, multiple times over in the Middle East, high commander in one of our elite military outfits. And he said, Todd, he goes, this is who I am. I'm a friend of your dad's. I know what you did. Washington Post had already had this article out. It was all over the news. And he said, this is what your next 72 hours is going to look like. And he painted a picture for me visually in my mind on where my mind was going to be in 72 hours. He talked about my headaches. He talked about my nightmares. He talked about my breathing. He talked about my speech, and being all mumble-jumbo. He talked about how I'm going to drive myself crazy trying to remember everything. And it was all pieced together in all different places. And it was absolutely amazing. He gave me a survival guide to live for the next 72 hours to figure things out. And so that was my first touch point of somebody really being vulnerable with me in that given moment.
It's incredible to just listen to the retelling, and we're very, very thankful and grateful that you're willing to do that for us and our viewers. I think David and I both, there are so many things that we could say, but it's incredible that in that moment, in that chaos, you did what your gut told you to do, and you saved a lot of lives. And you played such a role, and we're grateful.
Soon after the shooting, Bert visited Todd and his family. The Hall of Famer listened as his son detailed his experience.
My dad and I were sitting at the kitchen table, and we were just talking about things, and he said, "So, when are you going to get over this? Like, when do you think you're going to be okay?" And I said, "Dad, this isn't something you just get over." And he looked at me and he said, "Yeah, you're right. This isn't something you just get over." And for the first time, I saw like some tenderness and softness in him looking at me, and he knew I was struggling.
And I think just talking to him and seeing what it did to him emotionally, he was hurt. And I knew he was going to have to see somebody to try to get through it.
I've had a lot of calls from first responders. I have a lot of friends. I mean, I'm an athlete, so I always hung out with officers or firefighters, and I have tons of friends that are all first responders. Mm-hmm. EMT, some of our family members, they started as EMTs and then became a firefighter. And so I think when you go through a situation like that, it now, instead of those friends just being barbecue friends or mm-hmm. drinking friends or whatever it may be, like, I truly understand what you go through and where you've been and the hurt that you mm-hmm. feel, and that silence, the silence that happens when everything gets to that moment where you can really think about what the hell just happened to me. That's the scariest time. And I get it. Unfortunately, I get it. But that's what I'm trying to bring more light on. And that's, just sharing the great stories mm-hmm. of peer support groups that are popping up all over the country mm-hmm. now, and people becoming more vulnerable and walking tall for themselves.
Nearly 4 years later, Todd's still processing what happened in Vegas. And he's committed to therapy to help him move forward.
Allows me to process the good parts in that, remember the bad parts, but really lean more on the goodness of things, the love, the people coming out to help, selfless acts, being back with my wife. I get to be a dad to my amazing kids, and I get to be part of that.
So I think there's a reason I was put into that situation. I'm a big faith believer. I know I wasn't alone that night. I'm a 6'5 dude that is a pretty big target, and I definitely had bullets flying around me. I'm just so thankful that, I was able to live. But obviously I have a duty to now walk tall for those that did not. I'm a huge first responder advocate. I have had so many officers now, especially now going into EMDR and my journey mm. through therapy, that was tough. I tried to eat what happened in terms of when I say I tried to eat it, I tried to just deal with it internally. My headaches were pounding on my right side. I couldn't figure it out. God, I had these nightmares, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't figure out why my speech was all over the place. I was forgetting a lot of things. I'm still trying to do my job. At one point, I was working down in downtown Dallas, and the same song that Jason Aldean sang when the machine gun fire started, I won't name what it is. It used to be one of my favorite songs. But that came on the radio inside the office building, and I literally jumped up and I ran out and I ran down about half a block and I stopped and I'm like, what am I doing? Mm-hmm. What's going on? But now, like, I can't hear Jason's voice. And so some of the stories that, like, my great friend Brian Wood, he was a longtime Southern California officer, FBI terrorist task force liaison between his department and the FBI. And so he's done a lot of, you know, great things for our communities, our nation. And he talked about a call that he had and a first song that came on that he could not hear anymore. And so now there's a relation. They're like, okay, so what I'm experiencing is not abnormal. And so we start learning through the power of being able to be open with our own stories and our own adversities. And now I know, okay, I'm not alone. Lee shared that with me in the first 72 hours of what my walk of life was going to look like. Woody is now telling me things about his professional career in law enforcement and some of the things that he cannot do anymore and the therapy that he went to go get. So I had a fire captain in Rockland, California, a great friend of mine called me up and said, hey, you need to go get EMDR therapy. I've heard some of your stories and you like really need help. You need to go, you can't do this on your own. And so I started exploring it, found a couple therapists that looked great on paper and went to speak with a couple of them. And I got 13 seconds into my story and realized there's no way you're going to be able to absorb what I'm about to tell you.
Right.
I'm going to destroy your life and you are going to probably have worse nightmares than I have. So, you know, just like, because you have to be open. So if you're going to find a therapist, I can't give the therapist my PG version. I have to be as detailed as possible. And they have to walk me through that process. And luckily, and Bonnie, you know this all too well, like I found an amazing therapist that had military experience. So I kind of refocused my targeting on my search. Mm-hmm. I wanted to find somebody that had dealt with extreme battlefield chaos, right? That it helped military or law enforcement. Mm-hmm. So I looked more for a first responder type therapist that had been in boots on the ground and knew what I had what I felt, knew that feeling of silence, right? And so, oh man, her name's Diane Logren out of Dallas. She helped me so much, and we started doing 3MDR. And so my story, and I'll finish it up with this. My story of walking through EMDR, and you can explain this more on a professional side, but it allowed me to take all those little like 30-second or minute-long memories that were all over the place, and we put them in little black boxes and start to piece one together, one at a time. And every minute of that, I literally processed and broke down, and it was exhausting and it was hard. But the way in which she navigated through that, which ended up going from an EMDR therapy to a talk therapy, it was a combination, a hybrid towards the end, which I really enjoyed for me, just because I needed to break it up. And she was really, you know, soft in her approach. But it was time consuming. It was a year and a half of therapy that I went through to learn, because you never get over it, to learn how to walk tall again in my life and to process things and to have relaxation techniques when I start to go up, when I hear a siren go down the street or I hear that fire. I hate 4th of July. I used to love 4th of July. Now I can't stand it, but I understand where it's coming from. As long as I can get ahead of it, I'm fine. Mm-hmm.
The families, they should know that, man, there was so much love trying to get them out and save their life, you know, not just by me, but by all those people.
It seems to me that saving these people, you kind of saved yourself along the way.
It has completely transformed my outlook on life. I can't guarantee that tomorrow's going to happen, but today I'm here.
But I've had a lot of officers reach out, a lot of fire, military say that they gave up their first time of therapy, and now hearing my story, they're going to go back. They're going to be resilient, right? And they're going to try again. And that's all my biggest advice is, man, is if you can't find a therapist that works for you, start talking to friends that you trust. You're putting your life on the line with your brothers and sisters every single day you put that badge on. And if you're retired, you still have that community. And trust me, they're feeling exactly how you felt and how you're feeling. And together we can build enough information to hopefully maybe find a connection to somebody that can help you like you do, Bonnie, with being licensed and run you through EMDR or some type of therapy that's really going to help you and benefit you. So I'm just a huge advocate on that now and just making sure you're not alone. So everything that, like, David, you're talking about with some of these firefighter groups and organizations across the country that are doing some amazing peer support group. My buddy Woody that I mentioned was a huge advocate in Southern California providing peer support groups and being able to call somebody up and say, hey, there was a call that happened. Anybody know that individual? Let's get in touch with him, make sure he's okay.
Right.
But then that person, and we could talk about it if you like, but then that person has to be approachable, right? Mm-hmm. And the approachability factor that creates the vulnerability, that creates the trust, and then creates the accountability in those four areas, if we can tackle those and check off the box that, yeah, I did my tough stuff. I'm tough. Mm-hmm. I'm good. Like, I can wear a t-shirt if you want. I can, you know, hey, I'm a tough guy. I'm a tough person. I went through listening to some of the people on your podcast. They're all tough people. But, man, like, let's open it up. Open up that door crack. Let's be vulnerable. It's okay, because if our 100% tough meter is at 90%, we like living at 100%. So we need to be able to, like, fix that 10%. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, that 10% is going to dwindle down, and now we're going to be at 10% on the bottom, and we're going to be sitting by ourselves, right? So, it's been a journey, I'll tell you that much.
Well, I think this is, since you brought it up, Todd, it's a great moment to talk about approachability, and I know you've written some poetry recently, and some of it reflects on approachability. Would you be willing to share that with us?
I would. Yeah. This is so new to me. If you would have asked me 6 years ago to write a poem, I would have laughed and said, come on, man. Like, you want me to write a poem? But so through the course of time, yeah, I've been just putting these thoughts together. And then I've actually written a couple songs as well around the adversity we deal with through PTSD, first responders. And then obviously I have a poem called Resiliency Inc. about my tattoo. So anyways, I wrote one on the approachability. It's called Healing Hearts of Heroes. And I wrote this for all first responders. And the purpose of this is to talk about approachability in our lives. And so I'll read it. So, in tragedy's depths, heroes arise, soldiers, police, and those who give their lives. Witnessing loss, enduring pain, within their souls a battle remains. On the battlefield, lives fade away, firefighters face flames, civilians sway. In operating rooms, a desperate fight, where sometimes death conquers despite all might. As a civilian in the darkest of nights, I ran towards danger, holding tight. To woman, her last breaths I felt, a gunshot wound sealing her fate, my heart dwelt. But heroes, haunted by what they've seen, mask their pain, their nightmares unseen. Taught to be strong, emotions concealed, they soldier on, their wounds unrevealed. Seeking solace, they cry out in vain, unheard, dismissed, their suffering remains. Leaders unapproachable, their fears unmet, in silence, their anguish, they silently fret. One day, consumed by the weight, they succumb to darkness, believing their fate. That strength lies in silence and hiding the pain. Instead of seeking help, they let tragedy reign. Let us learn, be approachable and true. Extend our hearts, shine a guiding light through. For heroes and sufferers, they lost in despair, approachability can save. Show them we care. God calls us to be open, empathetic, and strong, to banish the shadows where hope belongs. Together we change the narrative we steer towards a world where approachability is clear. To heroes, brave souls, we offer our love, empathy, compassion, a comforting glove. In vulnerability, strength we find, creating a space where healing's defined. In tragedy's depths, there's hope to embrace, connection, grace, and a loving space. Approachability, a strength to impart, to heal wounds and mend broken hearts.
That's beautiful.
Incredible.
And that's part of your post-traumatic growth, right? The ability to write music and poetry. And we thank you so much.
Well, thank you for letting me share that. So, and I think you all, I mean, I know we all have stories. You don't have to go through a mass shooting to have adversity in our lives. It could be a car accident. It could be, anything. It could be getting yelled at. I feel, I've got a lot of family members that are law enforcement, first responders. And, thankfully, where I'm at in our state, there's a lot of respect for what first responders are doing. And I know it's across the country, and, our first responder community goes through a lot. And it could be someone yelling at them. And that's traumatic. So you need to talk about it, God, understand that it's not weak. It's really not weak. It's strong to talk about your fears and just be vulnerable, because that neighbor next to you, that brother and sister, or that comrade, or that person, maybe that EMT you're coming up on, you're opening up an opportunity for them to be vulnerable too. I'm sitting with I'm not going to mention who it was, but it was a fire, high commanding fire personnel in a place that we met through baseball. Our friends, our kids are all related. And this guy finds out what I ended up doing. We talk a little bit about it. It opened up a door for him to start sharing something that he's never shared before. And man, it was, I felt incredible just having the opportunity. I was so honored to listen to him, and you could feel the weight coming off. And so this individual and I, we've been talking, since, and there was that kind of bond of brotherhood right off the bat. Like, we've shared something together where we're both not alone now. And that's the whole idea, is building these rocks around you, right? Your support. You got to have those. I've got them all over now. In all probably parts of the world that are my rocks that I could call in any given moment, if things go south with me. So,
well, Todd, we have covered a lot, and I want to thank you for sharing everything you have. I think it's inspiring to hear your story, and most importantly, the transformation that grew from, the adversity of it, where you've had the wherewithal to look for help. And when you didn't find the right therapist right out of the gate, you did some brilliant moves, I think, to find somebody who was going to be able to work with you and hear your story and help you, find some peace and some closure. So I want to thank you from the bottom of our hearts for stepping up and walking tall in all areas of your life, because it's going to have a profound influence on everyone that hears you.
I appreciate it. And that's, the walking tall movement. It started with another mass shooting survivor, Chris Malazuski, that was in the Highland Park shooting, that did extraordinary things as well. And, I mentored him 2 days after that first shot. It was a connection through baseball. I was introduced, asked if I could help him, and he listened. He was approachable. Mm-hmm. And I've seen his growth, and I've been there. I'm one of his, he calls him the board of directors. That's his box. That's his way of doing it.
In terms of walking tall and everything else you do, and share with us how people can find you out there, social media, internet, and best way to get in touch with you.
Yeah. So I'm all over the internet as far as my social, my personal stuff, but really with the Walking Tall movement, it's walkingtallmovement.com. It's starting with a podcast similar to what you guys are doing, not at your scale, but we're bringing on guests to talk about adversity, you know, not just in mass shootings, but cancer and all types of different adversities that we deal with. So it's been a lot of fun there. But the movement part is growing beyond the podcast. And so I put myself out there as a keynote speaker to come in and talk with organizations about my vulnerability and being approachable. And so we're starting to work with a lot of colleges, athletic departments, businesses, teaching management how to walk tall for their employees and to be vulnerable. Because like we were talking about, it's one thing to for that manager now, if I go into that office, to put take his cap off and put his dad hat on, or put his put his soft hat on and be able to say, all right, tell me what's going on. Or that manager to go into an employee's office and say, hey, you have kids. Like, can we go get a coffee? I'm struggling right now as a parent, and I just want some different advice. All of a sudden now that employee or that younger firefighter is like, hold on, wait a second. Captain wants me to go get coffee with him and talk about like my kids. Okay.
Right.
What did that just do? It literally just even it bolstered on more team camaraderie. It gave more trust and vulnerability. And it just creates a way more cohesive environment to work in. And it's just powerful. And I'm excited to be able to go out and talk about it. I talk at churches as well. I have a faith-based platform just because I'm super into it. But, I appreciate it. It's walkingtallmovement.com, and then we have the podcast, which is Walking Tall Podcast.
Great.
Well, it's been incredible meeting you, Todd, and we feel like it's a blessing that we got connected. So thank you for everything you're doing, and I think you'll be helping a lot more people just by who listened today.
Well, I appreciate it. We're not alone. Right. And especially where you're at and everything that, you know, that whole Northeast has endured over the years. And I know, Bonnie, your own story and Lieutenant, like you guys are my heroes. And so I hope that the one person that's listening right now just knows they're not alone. Come on. Like, you're not. There are people that will help you. These two people right here, what you guys are doing and putting your podcasts up and having these amazing people come and tell their stories, listen to it. Just it's a tough thing to ask for help. That's what we need to keep focusing on. So thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. Yeah. Well,
thank you, Todd. It's been a real pleasure. And we look forward to some continued conversations with you as we collaborate down the road.
This episode is made possible by Cover, an all-natural, chemical-free mineral sunscreen lotion. Providing broad-spectrum protection in an SPF 30, Cover blocks 97% of harmful UVA and UVB rays, but it's light enough to allow your skin to breathe. First responders often spend long hours in the sun, and prolonged skin exposure is one of the hazards of the job. First responders love Cover because it won't stain clothing, and a 4-ounce bottle fits easily into a backpack or go bag. Go to kovr.respondertv.com to get 15% off all Cover sunscreen products. That's kovr.respondertv.com.
We'd like to invite everybody to like and subscribe on YouTube, Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc. and Responder TV. We're also on bbsradio.com, all the podcast platforms, and check out our website, respondertv.com, for past episodes and guest information. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself. Take care.